And we're back here on Unusual Sources 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you community activism, community action, international politics, linking the local to the global, and to all the activity we do here in Hamilton, at McMaster, in the community, in Hamilton Wentworth. And now I'm speaking with Kevin McKay, that's professor of social sciences at Mohawk College. He's coordinator of the Sky Dragon Community Development Cooperative and vice president of OPSU Local 240, although he's speaking on behalf of all his activist work today. So, Kevin, thanks very much for coming on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me, Brendan.
Well, it's not your first time on this program, not by a long shot, but you've been very busy in the last few months with the many hats you're wearing right now, many organizations you're part of and initiatives. Today on the program, one of the other guests is Igor from the Cuba Solidarity Association of Hamilton. He's got some initiatives going that you know about, but I thought maybe we should start with some context. We obviously have an imperialism problem right now with Iran and Venezuela and all that other stuff. So you had an article in your blog, which let's get to that issue right now. You have a blog called Rise Like Lions.
Yes.
And that is at riselikelions.ca, basically. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
And you're... publication of an article in January probably should have been discussed more. You have an article called Canada's Response to Maduro's Kidnapping. That's the President Maduro of Venezuela. The Canada's response to Maduro's kidnapping is dishonest and also dangerous. And that was a great article, which I did see circulated in Hamilton, and it should be discussed, especially now, as I think it provides some basis and reference for understanding what's going on in Iran and with Cuba and so forth, which all of these interrelated issues are coming to a head in some regard. So I saw some patterns being discussed in this article. One of the things is that the empire, in this case, the United States, it seems to like to kind of circle in. It circles in, gets like a spiral where it gets closer and closer to a country, to a target, and it wants to crush them, right? Like a boa constrictor. It starts out with the sanctions and it moves on from there. So in the case of Venezuela, what has the U.S. been doing? How does it circle in? How does it squeeze that country and utilize mechanisms to try and bend Venezuela to its will?
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question. I think you're right. It's a pattern that we see over and over again that the United States engages in when it's basically trying to either, you know, take out a potential competitor country or just to force a country to do what it is the United States wants, you know, to sign unfavorable trade deals, to offer up its natural resources for a song, like all of these things that the empire demands of basically any other country that can't resist its power. And they've been doing it, obviously, to Venezuela for decades now. I mean, this goes back quite some time. You know, most recently, I guess, in terms of a long history of U.S. intervention in the region is when Venezuela had the audacity to elect a government that actually reflected its own people's interests to a large extent when Hugo Chavez was elected. And I believe that was in 1998. And so from that point on, you had this Bolivarian Revolution. You had this really inspiring movement of, you know, poor and working class people in Venezuela that swept Chavez to power. And then immediately the government started, you know, doing literacy programs, food programs for poor people, you know, constitutional literacy programs, revamping the constitution and the representative structure. So all this amazing stuff. And also furthering what had actually happened earlier in Venezuela, which is nationalization of the oil industry. So it had happened before Chavez, but Chavez really, from my understanding, really deepened that nationalization in the sense that he took some of the power away from the domestic oligarchy within Venezuela, the families that had controlled the oil within the country. And so, you know, basically you have a populist left-wing government that is trying to govern in the interests of its people, trying to use its own oil wealth. And the states, of course, was not okay with that. And so I think ever since the election of Chavez, you had, you know, the attempted coup in 2002, which is quite an incredible and unprecedented thing where he was essentially deposed, Hugo Chavez. And then there was this really last second, thrilling Hollywood action movie counter coup that the palace guard pulled and was able to bring him back. And then since then, it's just been constant destabilization and provocation by the United States. And then when Hugo Chavez passed away and Nicolas Maduro took over, it's just been intensifying. We've seen the attempt to install this Juan Guaido, character as the true president of Venezuela. And to your point of there being a pattern, there is a pattern. Like, it's destabilization of the economy. So heavy sanctions have been a part of this, that the United States has leveled against Venezuela, trying to strangle its economy.
Well, we should take that one by one. I mean, it's very interesting what you outlined in the article. You kind of triggered me with some of the things you said because it reminded me of some very specific items. For example, the whole situation in Venezuela before Chavez became the president was many people were demonstrating on a regular basis. Some of these riots became so big that they got their own names, because people right now on, the talking heads on CNN or Fox will say, well, Venezuela used to be a rich country. It was a rich place. And then Chavez got in and they ruined it all. Actually, people were not able to meet their daily needs in terms of large urban and rural majorities. And you would see large demonstrations because Venezuela, of course, is a rich country in terms of natural resources. And some
Yes.
people, there was profit from those natural resources. Some people took a cut from that before the bulk of the cut went outside of the country. But for most people, they were not seeing the benefit of that and were actually living hand to mouth. And so Chavez did make changes and did make reforms, which galvanized support for him, as you said. And in terms of the mobilization level that happened in the country, I was briefly there for the World Social Forum around 2006 or 2008. And we were there for part of activist delegations and union delegations. There's whole stories that could be told about that. But I have never seen in this hemisphere such a politically charged environment as when I was there. There was demonstrations for the government, for Chavez, excited people in the streets with banners and flags. And there were anti-Chavez people, of course. And I remember we were walking down the street, part of a delegation heading to talk to some Brazilians, and some rich woman in a Cadillac slowed down her car driving by and she said, Fuera Chavez, which means out with Chavez. And but that's what it was like every second of every day there. It was, people talk about democracy. That was some of the most democratic things I'd ever experienced in this hemisphere. But like you say, the United States gets in very quickly and it starts its mechanisms, right? Its processes.
I'm reminded of, what John Perkins wrote about in his Diary of an Economic Hitman, and really talking about this kind of staged approach to when the United States wants to, either affect regime change in a country or increasingly just destroy a country, just literally render it an inoperable entity. I think Dan Kovalik's, recent book really highlights that this is an equal strategy of empire. If they can't install a friendly, stable client regime, they'd rather just trash the place, right? Like they've done with Libya, and like they've done with Syria. So, yeah, I think they got into Venezuela early. The sanctions were a big part of it. Obviously, a nonstop campaign within the West to demonize Chavez and then to demonize Maduro, to demonize socialism and the Bolivarian Revolution. And one of the interesting things, and I'm sure you've encountered this, and I find this very frustrating because you'll see a lot of discourse in the West vis-a-vis Venezuela saying exactly what you said. Oh, it used to be a rich country, now it's a poor country. Why? Because of socialism, right? And what these people saying this, they always leave out the fact that, Venezuela has been strangled with crippling economic sanctions. And economic sanctions that actually really affected its oil industry in the sense that it wasn't able to buy the equipment it needed to, improve its refining capacity, even to actually, drill and, export the oil that they needed to survive. So all of these things were steadily degraded, let alone things like medicines for hospitals, industrial machinery, that sort of thing. So yeah, you create a crisis in the country, basically, and you hope that then domestic unrest will overthrow the government and basically sort of do your work for you. And of course, we're seeing this same attempt right now in Iran. And it seems to be working about as well as it did in Venezuela, which is actually not that well. I mean, if you look at the US was able to kidnap Maduro, again, this flagrantly illegal violation of international law, international sovereignty, murdering over 100 people in the country, stealing their democratically elected president. And yet that government is still intact. Delcy Rodriguez seems to be moving forward essentially with the same government, the same program. So I think that what we've been seeing in Venezuela and now in Iran is the reach of empire, the persistence of empire, but also the limitations too. Like we really are seeing that it is possible for countries to resist. It's not easy, it's dangerous. There are consequences, and yet I think we're seeing more of this worldwide. And I think what's so inspiring and important about Venezuela is you have this decades-long history of this country, just like Cuba. Again, why Cuba is so important, let alone just for that own people's right to self-determination and their own human rights. That's important. But what they symbolize is effective resistance to empire. And I think that's why Canada needs to support them right now.
Yeah, I mean, Venezuela, it's got a long road ahead of it. The whole situation with Maduro and restoring, him and they elected certain people to be their president and such, and they should be able to serve out their term without being kidnapped by a foreign power. So there's that whole issue, and there's other countries involved. So we're going to see how that goes, right? There's a lot going on in the world right now, so we're going to see how it goes in Venezuela. It's interesting. I noticed that, and a lot of people noticed. In Venezuela, the opposition, there's certain types of people in particular that were opposing Chavez and then Maduro.
Yes.
When Venezuela was just a place where oil was pumped out and some people got rich off of it and everybody else didn't, there wasn't a lot of complaining from certain quarters. But then, when Chavez got elected and certain sectors of the population got represented politically, people in the barrios, people of mixed heritage, non-white people, people who had been colonized, victims of colonialism and racism, and when government started implementing programs to materially enhance their well-being, to redistribute oil wealth, to actually make a difference in people's lives with regard to literacy and so on. Not only was that opposed by elites in Latin America who are notorious, for kind of a royalist viewpoint, right? But
Yes.
the whole idea that these people should be represented at all was fiercely opposed in a number of
Definitely.
quarters. And so the opposition was always nasty. There was this local domestic opposition. And of course, the United States stepped in, as you pointed out, and enacted a number of measures to strangle the country economically, which is a story that we're all familiar with by now. The relation with Iran, I mean, we can go there, but you mentioned Cuba. And I want to pick your brain about that a little bit because you've been involved. I spoke with Igor from the Cuba Solidarity Organization in Hamilton, and I recalled that he had started, along with others, by having some kind of event. They had an inaugural event for this. Well, let me just get the proper name, of the organization here. Yeah, it's the Cuba Solidarity Association of Hamilton, right? And the first event, I was not present. I had another meeting that day, and you helped set that up at least. And so they had a solidarity event and an inaugural event, a cultural thing at the Workers' Arts and Heritage Center. That's what they did, right?
They did, and it was a cultural event. So there was music, there was food. It was successful. They raised $3,000, which then I'm sure Igor mentioned they used to purchase some much needed medical supplies that are earmarked for a specific hospital in Cuba that they've been working with. So yeah, it was a successful event. And then I think there's been so much going on. If you think about everything that's happened in the world since then, Venezuela. And then, Iran kicking off. So I think that, people were just scrambling around trying to deal with other situations. Palestine, obviously, too, being very important. But now Cuba has once more come to the forefront of people's consciousness. And so that's where I think the group is getting together again. And we just had a very, I think, successful meeting just this last weekend. And lots of energy, a good turnout, and I think lots of great ideas. And I think there's kind of two things that people are seeing as priorities right now, vis-a-vis Cuba. One is sort of a political imperative of trying to get our government to change its position. I think our government right now has sadly still this very cowardly vassal state, approach to Cuba, in the sense that we're towing the American party line. We're not giving them, I mean, we've given them a little bit of food aid, but we're not doing what we could do in terms of energy, oil, the sorts of things that Cuba really needs. We recently sanctioned a Russian oil tanker that was dropping oil off to Cuba. So all these things are profoundly unhelpful. So Canadians need to reach out to our government, pressure our government, protest, whatever avenues we have. To convince the Canadian government that now is not the time to be slavishly following a failed imperial policy. Like, I think the whole world now is realizing that the US empire, something that, Brendan, we've talked about this for years, if not decades, among our circles, that we know that there is this massive geopolitical shift happening, that the US empire is losing its power, is losing its control, and yet still dangerous and still lashing out and causing harm. But that's not the horse you want to back in this race. It's the multipolar world is where I think the future is, and that's where I think Canada's future should be. So vis-a-vis Cuba, Carney has an opportunity, Canada has an opportunity to start walking that talk of shifting allegiance. Carney gave this speech at Davos and he got all this fawning and slobbering over, what a noble statesman he was. Well, now he's had an opportunity to actually embody the idea of what he calls, values-based realism. And we're totally failing right now. So there's a political need, but also there's a direct material need right now for Cuba too. So Canadians can directly help Cubans. People all over the world can and are doing this, and it's incredibly important. Again, it's what's happening, we know, in Gaza as well, that just individuals are reaching out to try and support. So I think that the organization in Hamilton is focused on both of these tasks. So one is political advocacy, the other is we want to do more fundraisers, we want to fill shipping containers with food, we want to help, buy generators, all of these sorts of things.
It ties a lot of issues together, what you're saying. For example, we know that the population seems to be more advanced on a number of issues than the leadership of Canada, the politicians, Carney, and leaders of some other kinds of organizations. People support Cuba, right? You've talked to people. We know that people go on vacation a lot to Cuba or visit Cuba, and they know what's going on there to some extent. There's sympathy for their position, and people want to change that. And although the government says they're giving $8 million or something to Cuba, people are saying that's not enough. Given the blockade and our closeness to Cuba, we should be helping a lot more. And I know political activism is part of what this Cuba organization wants to do. And by the way, people that want to help out with that, check out the other interview today with Igor. He mentions the email addresses you can use to contact a Facebook group. It'll be posted on the electronic version of the event as well. So people can get involved with the Cuba event to both give material goods to Cuba through the blockade and also to engage in political activism to try to reverse the blockade and make Canada take a more proactive role. So on the issue of Cuba, Carney is not as advanced as a lot of people in Canada are, but also we see that with regard to elbows up in general in resisting the US annexation and the way Trump is talking. And finally, on the issue of Iran, and that's where we really see the disappointment you're referring to, where he did make all those claims at Davos about the direction he was going to take. And then, as soon as the United States and Israel recklessly bomb Iran, causing so much damage and turning the entire Middle East into a conflagration now, we expected that Carney might have some negative words about that policy, but instead he said, oh, yeah, it's great. Iran, that government's got to go. I support what the US is doing. So, what can we say about Canada?
I know, Brendan. It was incredibly disappointing, and I think it shows that movements within Canada, working people's movements, movements for peace and social justice, and environmental sustainability, all of these movements that are trying to come together, that need to come together. We have a lot of work to do in our country. We have rhetoric right now, but we don't have a real commitment to charting a path of sovereignty, first of all, and also of, anything approaching international law or respect for international, norms of cooperation. And, we're just
Like
not.
not bombing people during negotiations when they're offering everything you asked for.
Exactly. Like, you're right. All of these, like, and it's almost like sometimes you have to stop and really shake your head about just all of the international norms which are being absolutely shredded right now. Like, there is no pretense anymore of the rule of law. There's no pretense of, like you said, even just basic morality and decency in terms of, how can you negotiate with another party if there's zero trust? If you use those negotiations as an attempt to assassinate their leadership, right?
We're like three times in a row. That's
Yeah.
called perfidy.
It is. It's perfidy, it's mendacity, it's a whole lot of we could go through the list, right? But I do think it's, to be serious about it, it's a momentous time, I think, and a dangerous time. And I think that we really have to work hard in our country, first of all, to help people understand the moment, the gravity of the moment, and understand the stakes. And then we need to start pushing in the right direction. Like I said, we need to de-link from this floundering empire. And I think that's where the last thing I'll say is that, that's why in my article I said that our current stance is dangerous, because if we stay roped to this sinking, flailing empire, this is not going to be good for Canada, for Canadian citizens, for our future stability and prosperity. And I think we need to start understanding that as well. So it is partly about our own national sovereignty and safety, and even one might argue survival, depending on what happens south of the border. So yeah, solidarity is the right thing to do morally, but also I think it's in our own interest as Canada to be taking the opportunity to support our fellows in Latin America, our fellow Americans, right? Be they in Mexico or Cuba or Colombia or Venezuela, we should be in solidarity with these countries, not with the imperial United States.
Yes, exactly. People can get involved with the local Cuba Solidarity Committee in Hamilton. They can go to your blog, riselikelions.ca, and read the article about Venezuela. Canada's response to Maduro's kidnapping is dishonest and dangerous. They can do that. We have a demonstration coming up this weekend on Sunday afternoon in Hamilton. Obviously, people are very upset about what is being done to Iran and the entire region now. So that's going to be announced in various places, such as the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website and its Instagram page, and various people on social media and such. So there'll be plenty of notice about that, and people can check that out. Kevin, I'm really grateful that you're able to bring your perspective on all of this, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, how similar these are in so many ways. So thanks for being on the program, and we'll see you on Sunday at the demonstration.
Thanks so much, Brendan. I'll be there. And thank you for all the incredible work you're doing.